Welcome to the second of this series of lectures, and I'm extremely pleased to welcome Lord Carrington. We were just discussing the interest that he was Foreign Secretary around about the time a substantial number of people in this room were born. He was Foreign Secretary from 1979 to 1982, ending his career as Foreign Secretary with something which has become increasingly unfashionable in recent years, which is that he resigned on a matter of principle, and went briefly out of politics, returning to become Secretary General of NATO for several years. I should add that he first became a minister in 1959, when a rather larger proportion of the people in this room, I think, had not been born. So his political memory of changes in the way in which British foreign policy has been made and the increasingly multilateral nature of foreign policy, he has seen from both ends, because, as you know, the Secretary General of NATO has as his job to try and persuade the members of NATO that they should work together rather than following their natural preferences. It's a very great pleasure to introduce him. He is also, if I may say so, one of the splendidly old-style conservatives who always pretends that he's not quite as intelligent as he is, that he's not quite as wide awake as he is, and in that sense represents the best of the old Tory party. Lord Carrington.
Well, you can see he's an old friend, can't you? I'm very grateful to be asked here tonight, but I must say I find it rather daunting. I'm not just because of you, but I'm rather worried that I shall be contradicted or shall contradict all the other people who are going to speak to you later on. And I noted with interest that David Owen's talk was called "The Ever-Growing Dominance of Number 10 in British Diplomacy Since the 5th of April, 1992, and more particularly, 82, I think it was, and more particularly, the date on which he maintains that number 10 became dominant in foreign affairs. And I'm happy to say that it was the day I resigned as Foreign Secretary. It will be interesting to see how my successors deal with the slur on their independence. I entitled this talk "Continuing Problems" because some people may think that, and I'm sure none of you, but some people may think that an incoming Foreign Secretary has the world at his feet, but he has to deal with events as he finds them. Of course, it would be splendid if one came into office with a clean sheet, a world with no wars, a world of, in which all disagreements had disappeared, quarrels and differences resolved, and he or she could announce with a great flourish that henceforward British foreign policy would start afresh. New initiatives, which as a prospective Foreign Secretary he'd prepared during the years of opposition, would transform Britain and Britain's standing in the world, and of course his prospects as well. Alas, it's not like that. I had an experience on the other side of the fence at one time. I was rather unexpectedly parachuted many years ago to be High Commissioner in Australia. And the office at that time, the office in London at that time, didn't think it worthwhile to airmail the dispatches of European ambassadors to Canberra. They came by sea. And I remember reading one in 1958, which went something like this. I spent a dismal Sunday talking to a sad, lonely old man who knew that never again would he have the opportunity to lead his country and follow his destiny. And when I read it, General de Gaulle had been back in power for 3 years, 3 months. It taught me to be very careful of making any predictions in my dispatches, and later on, as Secretary of State, to be as careful in believing the predictions of others. But there we are. I call this talk Continuing Problems. And an incoming secretary has to deal with the problems which faced his predecessors, and some of them very long-standing and seemingly impossible to resolve. And of course, you also have to address the divisions in your own party, which are usually quite as deep as those between the two parties, three parties, I beg your pardon. For example, the position of Britain in Europe is as controversial between the Conservative and Labour parties, in the Conservative and Labour parties, as it is between them. And Iraq, of course, is another issue which divides parties. But on the whole, foreign policy has been bipartisan. And that really isn't particularly surprising, because the Foreign Secretary is there to look after British interests, and those are not usually a matter of party politics. And when I became Foreign Secretary, the world was still divided between East and West. The Cold War, though not at its height, was still very important, and perhaps the most important issue in our foreign policy. The threat to our way of life seemed then as real, and our support for the Atlantic alliance was as crucial as ever it had been. But surprised though I was, as an hereditary peer, to find myself as Foreign Secretary, I must say I wasn't very surprised to see the other issues on my desk, which were pretty familiar. And I've called them the continuing problems. And the three that I've chosen will probably be very familiar to some of you. But I think there are possibly some lessons to be learnt from them and the way that we handle them. Two of these were on my desk in 1979, Zimbabwe and the Falklands. The third, Yugoslavia, with which I became involved, was some years later. The first, Zimbabwe. Over the years, successive British governments had tried to solve what had become an increasingly difficult and dangerous problem. And in 1979, the position became more acute. And what is more, an inordinate amount of Foreign Office time was occupied with that problem. And it was spilling over into our relations with the European Union, the United States. The president at that time was President Carter, and with the whole of the Commonwealth. And there had, as some of you may recall, been an election in Zimbabwe, Rhodesia, as it then was, which Bishop Muzorewa, supported by the white Rhodesians, had won an overwhelming victory. The trouble was that Joshua Nkomo's party and Robert Mugabe's party had not been allowed to take part in that election. And so the result was clearly not representative of the broad specter of opinion in the country. And awkwardly, the Conservative government was faced with a semi-pledge that if Lord Boyd, who was asked to investigate the election, said that the election was fair, then there might be recognition of that regime. He did so. And indeed, as far as those sort of elections go, it was fairly conducted. And the difficulty that faced the government, and I suppose particularly me, wasn't just that the two main opposition parties in that country had not taken part, but that with the exception of South Africa, no other country would have recognized the Muzorewa regime, and indeed the consequences would have been very serious. That President Carter made it fairly clear where he stood, as did the Europeans, and the Commonwealth as a whole, and there was a groundswell of opinion in the Commonwealth, that the Muzurewa regime not only was unacceptable, but would lead to possible breakup of the Commonwealth and indeed even sanctions against us. And I must say that the added difficulty from my point of view was that this was one of the issues which didn't divide the Labour Party, but certainly divided the Conservative Party. A substantial body of opinion on the right wing of the Conservative Party believed not only that the Muzurewa regime should be accepted, but that black majority rule, which incidentally all parties were committed to, would be a disaster and betrayal of the whites. There was a thing which probably none of you heard of called the Suez Group, which was belligerently opposed to a settlement. And there was quite a substantial body of opinion in the Conservative Party in favour of Ian Smith. We felt, therefore, that it was essential, for all these reasons, that it was essential to try again to get some sort of negotiated settlement. And it so happened that the Commonwealth heads of government were meeting in Lusaka just before the end of the year, and it seemed right to try and arrange a conference at that time in London, which for the last time, at any rate, we would try and settle the issue. And the conference did take place, and it was agreed at Lusaka. And I think one of the important lessons of that was that once the conference started and everybody had agreed to come, it was really very difficult for the parties concerned just to get up and walk out. And more particularly, the African delegates knew that the only possible alternative to the conference, to the agreement at the conference, was the recognition of the Muzurewa regime, which was to them politically quite unacceptable. Of course, that didn't mean that there was not a lot of bargaining and histrionics and prevarication. It certainly were. I think one factor in the eventual success of the conference was the decision to exclude from the conference and its surrounding buildings all those who were not directly involved. That to say, this was an internal matter for Zimbabwe and Britain and no one else. And we excluded from that conference and from the lobbying the presidents of the neighboring countries who were extremely anxious to get in on the act. And I remember particularly the outrage on the part of President Nyerere, but I think it was absolutely right. For me, it was a fairly disagreeable 3 months. Lightened sometimes, but not very often, by a touch of humor. When I had to announce that we were proposing to send a British governor to restore political legitimacy to the country, and that Christopher Soames had decided to accept the poison chalice, it wasn't likely to go down very well with anybody. The whites didn't want a return to colonial rule, and the blacks didn't want a white governor. And when I announced it, there was absolute dead silence. For at least half a minute, nobody spoke. And then Joshua Nkomo, who was a fat, round, jolly man, with other attributes as well, but a fat, round, jolly man, put up his hand and he said, "Will he have plumes and a horse?" And as a result of that intervention, the whole everything went moderately well. God bless the shade of Joshua Nkomo. Well, as you know, in the event, we got an agreement and an election which, broadly speaking, was as fair and representative as that kind of election is likely to be. Subsequent events are, I'm afraid, only too well known to all of us. But it's fair to say that for the first 15 years of the independence of Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe behaved with magnanimity and with a realization that the whites in Zimbabwe were vital in the success of the economy. After all, he'd been in Tanzania and Mozambique, where the expulsion of the whites had led to economic disaster. And it was really only when things were going wrong largely due to his economic mismanagement, that he decided to play the racist card and, alas, the welfare of Zimbabwe, its people and its economy, became less important than the welfare and survival of President Mugabe. But all that was in the future. And it's interesting, I think, to speculate why that conference was a success and all its predecessors were a failure. And I think the answer is quite simple. For one reason or another, all the parties concerned wanted a settlement. The Smith government was in real difficulty. The manpower and the economy were stretched to the limit. So many men were fighting against the Patriotic Front. The economy was in danger of collapse. After a period of 15 years or so, sanctions were beginning to bite. Moreover, the South Africans were no longer prepared to help the Smith regime, and their help was absolutely vital for the survival of Ian Smith. It was in the interests of both the white Rhodesians and the South African government that there should be a settlement. Insofar as Nkomo was concerned, Nkomo, you may know, was really the father of the independence and the Patriotic Front, and he was becoming increasingly sidelined by Mugabe. He was getting on in years, and he wanted to be the president of the new republic, and time wasn't on his side, since Mugabe was becoming increasingly dominant. President Kaunda of Zambia, where he, Nkomo, lived with all his army, was getting thoroughly fed up with having Nkomo and his army there and wanted and restive about the problems that Nkomo was causing him. To Mugabe, however, there were no such problems. His troops were doing the fighting, he believed he was winning, and it was only a matter of time before he won the battle. But his supporters, in the shape of President Nyerere in Tanzania and President Machel in Mozambique, were becoming increasingly worried at the consequences of the war in Zimbabwe. And they were great importers of food from that country at that time, and the consequences of the fighting were pretty bad for him. So they were putting pressure on Mugabe to agree to a negotiated settlement. So it was for a variety of reasons that all the parties concerned were prepared for a conference. Of course, they all thought they were going to get their own way. Otherwise, they wouldn't have come to the conference. But it didn't turn out like that, and I think it became increasingly difficult for them to leave the conference. Well, what are the lessons to be learned from all that? Of course, whatever the problems of a particular dispute and the difficulties, we've always got to try and find a settlement, even in the most unpromising circumstances. But realistically, no solutions are going to be found unless the participants are either willing to compromise, need a solution, or are in the position of having their arms twisted to accept a compromise. And you see that today clearly in the problems of Palestine and Israel and, of course, in Northern Ireland. And I think, above all, it's very important that whoever is in charge should see that there is a moment when a settlement is possible and not let the opportunity go by. The second problem was the problem of the Falklands. And perhaps you need no reminding of the issues involved. The islands had been a matter of dispute between Britain and Argentina over a great many years. There had, of course, over the years been desultory negotiations, but no prospect of agreement. The Argentinians claimed the islands to be Argentinian, and we maintained equally vigorously that they were British. Over fairly recent years, before 1979, there had been a gradual escalation by the Argentinians of their claim for the islands, and fruitless negotiations had taken place. And I came to the conclusion, just after I became Foreign Secretary, that if we were to avoid serious trouble, it was necessary to try yet again to negotiate some kind of settlement. The difficulty was to find a negotiating position which would be acceptable not only to the Argentinians, but also to public opinion in this country. And I thought that if we made no sign of being prepared to negotiate or making any proposals, the Argentinians, under a volatile dictatorship, might well use it as an excuse for taking further action in the United Nations and elsewhere, and possibly armed intervention. I came to the conclusion that if we didn't find a negotiating position, the situation would inevitably deteriorate. And the proposal which we floated, which even now seems to me a perfectly reasonable, credible negotiating tactic, was to suggest, rather on the lines of Hong Kong, that we should accept Argentine claim to sovereignty, but negotiate a very long lease of 100 years or more, which would guarantee the continuance of the Falkland Islanders' livelihood, nationality, and integrity. And the world in 100 or in 150 years would be a very different place from what it was then. Now, I have no idea whether this would have worked or not, or whether it would have been acceptable to the Argentinians. But it would certainly have been an issue on which we could negotiate and prolong those negotiations to a point which would at any rate postpone action on the part of the Argentine. But the fact was that such a tactic was completely unacceptable to large numbers of members of the House of Commons. Those on the right of the Conservative Party maintained that it was intolerable to suggest that a British colony should be handed over to a foreign country, and quite regardless of the lease. And those on the left of the Labour Party objected to a proposal which handed over any British territory to a fascist dictator. The lease proposal died amidst a very great deal of acrimony. And when it died, the prospect of any serious negotiation with Argentina died too, and we all know what the consequences were. Now, no government could have survived the understandable feeling of humiliation of the British people if there had not been a resolute attempt to recapture the islands. And when I say that, I don't detract in any way from the courage of Margaret Thatcher, particularly since I remember when I was Secretary for Defense that successive chiefs of staff had given an opinion that if the islands had been invaded by the Argentinians, the recapture would be extremely difficult, if not impossible. And incidentally, though it has nothing to do with what I'm supposed to be talking about, the Falklands conflict enabled Margaret Thatcher to win the next election by an enormous majority, which until then she would undoubtedly have lost. What then are the lessons to be learned from that? In my judgment, the cause of this conflict was the split in both the two major parties as to whether or not there should be a continuation of negotiation and the basis on which it should be conducted, and more particularly, the lack of understanding of the consequences of an end to the negotiations. The reception of the lease proposals was so hostile and the support of the moderates so lukewarm that at any rate at the time, it seemed pointless to pursue the proposals. Perhaps in hindsight, we should have tried harder. though I don't think it would have made any difference. And I must say that the cabinet itself was fairly half-hearted. And I think, too, in hindsight, that I relied too much on intelligence reports about the likely intentions as opposed to the ascertainable facts, such as military capabilities and dispositions. Intelligence passed to me was that there would be no recourse to armed intervention until all avenues of mediation, and in particular until procedures in the United Nations had been exhausted. It is, of course, very difficult, and I speak here in the light of some fairly recent events, to make a judgment about the intentions of a potential adversary as opposed to hard facts. It must be a matter of judgment, and that is very difficult indeed. But you know, when you're dealing with a dictator, as I was, and a dictator who was in considerable domestic difficulty, it's unwise not to assume that a military adventure, which would certainly be popular in his own country and divert attention from his problems at home, wouldn't be an attractive option for a desperate man to adopt. One more lesson, if I may, from those days when I was Foreign Secretary. We, the British, were in dispute. You will remember this very well. We, the British, were in dispute with the rest of the European community about the British budgetary contribution. Though the previous government had valiantly tried to put this right, there had been no result except increasing ill will between ourselves and our European friends. And I remember very well how much I wanted to improve relations with Europe, but the budgetary problem bedeviled our relations. I think that our European friends were much too inflexible in their attitude to our problem, for there wasn't any doubt that we had right on our side and we were paying far too much in comparison with others whose economy at that time was much stronger. And after all, if we decided that we weren't prepared to pay, they would have had to pick up the bill anyway. The Prime Minister, Mrs. Thatcher, was absolutely determined that we would not be browbeaten into accepting the status quo or an inadequate compromise, and she made this very clear. Indeed, some of the more mature members of this audience might remember an occasion widely publicized during a European summit in which she declared in no uncertain terms, "I want my money back." This attitude was considered by a number of those who were not always in agreement with her policy to be a rather strident demand to be made to such an august diplomatic international assembly. Certainly the leaders of France and Germany were inclined then and afterwards to raise their eyebrows at her determination not to be railroaded to an acceptance of something which was not, in her judgment, in the country's interest, and the rather positive way in which she made that plain. Well, all I can tell you is that had she not been as resolute and as single-minded as she was, we wouldn't have got the satisfactory conclusion that we eventually did. Of course, there was blood on the floor afterwards, but it was a very good example in international affairs of someone taking a position which they believed to be right and being prepared to press their case until they were successful. And the grudging respect for her at that time, together with her fortitude over the Falklands, I think stood us as a country in good stead during the years of her prime ministership. Lastly, I would like, if I may, just to spend a minute or two on the breakup of Yugoslavia and subsequent events. You will forgive me, perhaps, if I just explain the position and the positions it was and why I became involved. I don't think the breakup of Yugoslavia would have happened if the confrontation between East and West had still been there. Tito died, and Marxism died as well. The chief ministers of the several republics detaching themselves from the center, and incidentally, from a constitution which the redoubtable Tito had devised and which was completely unworkable, had become nationalists in their own republics rather than communists. And this development took place immediately after the Gulf War. And the Americans took the view, and I think quite understandably took the view, that having taken the overwhelming lead in the Gulf War, the Yugoslav problem, which was a European problem, should be the responsibility of the European Union. And the European Union took the view that it would be greatly to the advantage of the stability of Europe if Yugoslavia remained one country. Its breakup might lead to difficulties on the fringes of Europe, and in particular, the erstwhile Soviet republics. Consequently, it was suggested that there should be a constitutional conference, and they asked me to take the chair. Historically, before the formation of Yugoslavia, the Europeans had been divided in their attitude to the Serbs and the Croats. The Germans and Austrians, for historical reasons, were always supportive of the Croats. Indeed, the Germans, during the Second World War, gave Croatia independence for the first time in its history. The French, on the other hand, had always been supporters of the Serbs. Consequently, there was no consensus in the European community as to who was right or who was wrong. As a matter of fact, it's rather interesting to speculate what the Foreign Secretary of the European Union, under its new constitution, would have done in those circumstances, or indeed what he would have done in the circumstances of Iraq. But Europeans were divided. The Serbs should be condemned for invading Croatia. Equally, the Croatians should be condemned for declaring their independence without any safeguard for the 600,000 Serbs who lived in that country. The Serbs' memory were long, and they remembered the execution and exile of so many of the 1,200,000 Serbs who were living in Croatia in 1942. Now, it seemed to me that the only way in which the entity of Yugoslavia could be preserved was in a federal state in which the republics could decide how far they wanted to integrate with the federal authorities, some more, some less, a sort of a la carte situation. And although the war was raging between the Serbs and the Croats, the conference got underway and we made some progress, though clearly the sticking point was going to be Milosevic. Milosevic, whatever his failings, was prepared to say yes or no and stick to it. Of course, he mostly said no. But President Tudjman, the Croatian, almost invariably did the opposite of what he'd promised. Now, I don't know whether if the conference had continued, we would have been successful. Probably not, given the character of those involved. But it so happened there was no opportunity to find out. The Germans decided that they wished to recognize as independent countries Croatia and Slovenia. The proposal, which was accepted by the European foreign ministers in Brussels, after a discussion in which quite a number of those foreign ministers who disagreed profoundly with the proposal barely raised their voices. And that spelt the end of the conference. If Croatia was independent, the Serbs and the others were no longer interested in any federal proposals or any constitutional arrangements. And more importantly, if the European Union was prepared to recognize the independence of Croatia, they had to offer independence to the other republics, and in particular Bosnia. Now, the Bosnians had had a referendum in which the Bosnian Serbs had voted overwhelmingly that they were not prepared to accept an independent Bosnia under the constitution. And in that constitution, they and the other parties had a right of veto. Consequently, after the independence of Bosnia, which President Izetbegovic could hardly refuse, it must inevitably have led to a civil war, as indeed it did, and incidentally, which I had told my European friends that it would. Well, now, what followed is known to all of us. NATO intervention, United Nations intervention, finally American intervention, and in the end, a Dayton Agreement, which, as a matter of fact, was almost identical to the proposals that Josie Cotaliero and I made 3 years earlier, but which had been rejected. But then, at the time of the Dayton Agreement, as I pointed out in what I had to say about Zimbabwe, all the parties, for one reason or another, wanted a settlement. Now, what lessons can one learn from that very dismal episode? I suppose if you stand back and look objectively, the intervention by the Europeans, so far from resolving the problems, actually made them much worse. If there had been no European intervention and involvement, there would have been practically no ethnic cleansing, far fewer casualties. It would all have been over in a comparatively short space of time. And since both Milosevic and Tudjman separately told me that they had come to an agreement to carve Bosnia up between them, the Bosnian Muslims would have been a sacrifice for that quick solution. But I don't think it would have been possible for the European Union not to become involved, to ignore a war on your doorstep and the consequences that might flow from it, was really not a credible option. But peacekeeping and peacemaking in that particular situation proved very difficult. The effort to be neutral and not take sides left the three warring parties absolutely convinced that we favored the other two. And much the same was true of the United Nations peacekeeping force. An added obstacle was the crazy decision to send a United Nations force to keep the peace, expressly forbidden to use their arms except in self-defense. A grave mistake compounded by the declaration of safe areas. They weren't safe. Well, what are the lessons of that? If intervention in a civil war or the sort of Yugoslav situation is necessary, it's very much better that we should know on whose side we are and act accordingly. Umpires in white coats in a situation of war are in an impossible position. I remember in a book that Lord Slim wrote, he recalls a riot in the Red Fort in Delhi, and a young soldier turning to his sergeant and saying, "What do you mean by neutral?" "Neutral, my lad," replied the sergeant, "means that when you go down to that bloody bazaar, you're just as likely to be hit by a Mohammedan brick as by a Hindu brick." Secondly, to send soldiers to keep the peace with the sort of instructions they were given is unfair on them and can lead to real trouble. To send a United Nations force or a NATO force to keep the peace with the strict instructions that they can only use their weapons to defend themselves, while at the same time announcing that there are safe areas guarded by those forces was not only misleading, but led to some of the nastiest instances in the whole of the war. One last reflection. I'm quite a lot older than my colleagues who have spoken or who are going to speak to you. I am almost an endangered species. Apart from the last 12 years or so, as a boy, as a young man, as an adult, I have lived all my life in the shadow of a world war. I was at Sandhurst at the time of Munich and in the army before the Second World War. And I remember how ill-equipped we were and my astonishment at the threat of war, which didn't apparently spur the government of the day into doing anything about it. And after 6 years of war and success, we realized that we were faced just as dangerous by just as dangerous and threatening an enemy. And that Cold War lasted for over 50 years. And we lived with the threat of a disastrous nuclear war, which on occasion seemed very close. But in all that, there was one positive feature. The potential horrors of that nuclear war imposed a discipline upon everybody, not just East and West, but on the Third World as well. The rivalry between the two superpowers spilt over into the underdeveloped countries, which both superpowers sought to influence, and of course to the non-aligned countries as well. The rivalry between the two superpowers imposed a discipline on all of us in case a spark in one part of the world would set off a nuclear explosion which would engulf all of us. I said earlier, just to give one example of that, I don't believe there would have been a breakup of Yugoslavia. Their leaders would have calculated that the Soviet Union might decide to move in to secure ports on the Adriatic, a situation which the Americans would certainly not have accepted. But the breakup of the Soviet Union changed everything. There was now only one superpower with the military, industrial, and economic power to influence and indeed to control events. And however unwillingly, the United States took on the role of the world's policeman. They did so in Kuwait. They masterminded a political and military coalition to help them. Initially, they left the problem of Yugoslavia to the Europeans, but in the end, they had to come in and settle it. Now, I think we should be immensely grateful to them. But events in Iraq have proved much more difficult, both for the Americans and for their allies. In the event America, with a few allies, went ahead, despite the vigorous protests of some of their closest European allies. Now, I don't want to discuss the rights or wrongs of what the Americans or the French or the Germans did. I understand the irritation of the Americans at what was said and done in Europe. And I understand, too, the nervousness of those who opposed the war as what they thought was American unilateralism. But what has been done. And I think what is important is to repair the damage. As one who believes passionately in the importance of Atlantic relations and the global stability that such a relationship brings, that is all important. No country, however powerful, can indefinitely go it alone. Friends and allies are necessary. As for the Europeans, they must understand the problems which face a world policeman. When we ran the world, which I think we did rather well in the 19th century, we were cordially disliked No one likes a dominant power. Jealousy, hostility, and certainly not gratitude was our experience. There must be understanding on both sides. And the sooner the rift is healed, the sooner, in my judgment, the world will be a safer place.
Thank you very much indeed. Perhaps I might just be allowed to translate one of Lord Carrington's phrases when he said that the Lancaster House Conference on Rhodesia, Zimbabwe was, I quote, fairly disagreeable. Lord Carrington was in the Guards Armoured Division in the Second World War, and I think he would probably also describe his experiences between D-Day and June 1945 as fairly disagreeable.
Well, they were.
That's the... when I talk about the self-deprecation of the English gentleman, that's what it means. He's very kindly said he is willing to answer questions, so I invite anyone who would like to ask the first question.
Thank you. Can you speak up?
I was in the Guards Armoured Division, and as a result, I'm very deaf, so speak up.
Okay, yes. your concluding remark was obviously about wanting to see transatlantic relations, kind of how you want to see them prosper after the recent splits. So the point is, what role do you think the Bilderbergers will have to play in that? Since for the last 40 years, I presume that's been the behind-the-scenes role in trying to foster good transatlantic relations.
Oh, the Bilderberg?
Yes. Do you see that as playing a good behind-the-scenes role in fostering transatlantic relations for what your concluding remarks are about?
The Bilderberg Conference, of which I was chairman for 10 years, is totally misunderstood. It never made any decisions or came to any conclusions of the smallest value, and no decisions were taken anyway. But what it was important was that it enabled people who were of some consequence on both sides of the Atlantic to meet for 2 or 3 days, both politicians and businessmen, on both sides of the Atlantic, and get to know each other, and therefore forge some sort of understanding. That was the real value of the Bilderberg Conference. The debate really didn't matter a bit.
Thank you. The question over here. I didn't see. Well, put up your hands again. I can see you. Yes, the man there.
Tempting as it is to look back from my age, I would like to look forward and ask Lord Carrington, does he not think that the European Constitution proposed would have perhaps avoided the precipitate recognition of Croatia by Germany and would have avoided the precipitate attack on the United Nations by Britain and America?
I think that really depends upon whether you think that people's, in the future, countries' attachment to the European Union will be more important to them than what they believe to be their historical backgrounds and their own interests. Maybe, maybe not. Certainly my experience in Yugoslavia didn't lead me to think that the European Union and its foreign policy came much into the decision of either the French or the British or the Germans as to how they were going to proceed. I have my doubts as to whether there would have been all that much difference in Iraq. I don't suppose. I mean, I can't speak for the Prime Minister, nor can you. I mean, maybe the wrong party. But I would rather doubt whether Mr. Blair, having made up his mind about what was right or wrong, would have been deflected from what he was doing because of anything that anybody in Europe said. I think over the years this may happen. When historical differences and traditions and disappear, but I think it's going to be quite some time before that does happen. I think it'd be a good thing if it did, as long as they all agree with us.
Thank you. This one here.
Lord Carrington, you alluded in your comments about the Falklands to the difficulty of judging the intentions of states. I wonder if you could tell us what you think about the US, the Bush administration's doctrine of preemptive defense as set out in the nationals.
You mean what did I think about the Iraq war?
No, about...
US national security strategy.
The doctrine of preemptive defense.
That is.
Well, whether in general there is a justification for changing international law, changing Article 51 of the UN Charter in light of new threats, weapons of mass destruction, and the possibility that they might fall into the hands of terrorists.
Well, I'll tell you where I stand, which I expect is very unpopular. I think that if there was evidence that there were weapons of mass destruction, and credible evidence there was weapons of mass destruction, I think it was perfectly legitimate to go in and sort them out. After all, Saddam had got a particularly unpleasant reputation, seeing what he'd done in Kuwait and what he'd done to his own people. I think that would have been perfectly legitimate. I think regime change is not legitimate. I don't think that one should go in and change somebody's regime because you don't like it. It'd be rather good if we could in many cases, I think, but somebody might do it to us, and I don't think that would be at all a good idea. And so I think you've got to have some kind of a legal backing for that. But the thing that puzzles me about all this and about weapons of mass destruction, perhaps you can tell me the answer to this, but I've never really understood why, if the Iraqis, if Saddam Hussein never actually had any weapons of mass destruction, why he was so obstructive in the United Nations and with the Americans until right at the moment when the Americans were going to war, when it was quite clearly that the Americans were going. And I do not understand why that happened. And nobody's been able to explain that to me. And I find it very, very peculiar. I suppose in a way that I'm a little biased because there was a moment when I was Foreign Secretary, and at that time we were supporting Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein, as far as we were concerned, was a better bet in the Iran-Iraq war than Iran was. The Iranians were the baddies and the Iraqis were the goodies. And on two occasions I have to go and see Saddam Hussein. And I have to tell you, I find him deeply unattractive.
Perhaps I might be allowed to add on that, that I was in Moscow in June, since I sit on the board of a Russian international journal, and went with a French and a German colleague to see Mikhail Gorbachev the following day, who had on two occasions gone to see Saddam Hussein to try to persuade him to avoid both wars, and was thus the last outsider to talk to Saddam Hussein before this war. And what he told us, in effect, was that Saddam Hussein had simply lost contact with the outside world or with any sense of what the consequences were, and was thus unable to understand the logic which his ex-Soviet friend, as it were, was doing his best to explain to him about what he had to do to avoid a war. This is, as you were saying in your speech, one of the problems about dictatorships, that they lose their sense of what's possible and what's practical. A little question here.
A terrible mistake.
Huge mistake.
Thank you. My question is, how practical is a common European foreign and defense policy?
Well, I don't think one wants to be too pessimistic about that. I mean, 95% of the time, we all agree with each other and do have a common foreign policy. But there are occasions when, for various historical reasons, we do disagree with each other. I remember in the 70s, the irritation that Henry Kissinger had about the inability of the American administration to know what our common policy was about the Israel-Palestine situation. And he used to grumble about it. I mean, I told him that I didn't think that was really a very good objection, because the only thing that he would really dislike even more was that if we did have a common policy, then it wasn't his. But the fact is that, on whole, we do have a common foreign policy. But I don't think that in the foreseeable future, when issues like Iraq arise, that we are going to find it very difficult to have, we're going to find it very easy to have one.
Yes, there were a few events that happened during your tenure as Foreign Secretary that I was wondering if you could discuss your reflections on them, because you implied that the Cold War was sort of steady throughout this 50-year period, but of course the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan happened in 1979, and then martial law was also declared in Poland, and I wondered, from the perspective of the British Foreign Office, what was it like to be in the midst of what seemed to be the second Cold War? I mean, were these seen to be crisis points over which Britain could have some sort of influence?
Mm-hmm. Yes. The events of December 1979, when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan and the declaration of emergency in Poland, how did you see that? Was it a second Cold War getting really deeper again, or was it something once we had to manage?
I think it was just a continuation of what was happening before, quite frankly. I don't think there was very much difference. The extraordinary thing about the Cold War, you know, one's got to be very careful not to say bring back Brezhnev, everything will be marvellous, because everybody will be too frightened to do anything in case of a nuclear war. But there really were advantages from the point of view of the discipline in the rest of the world about the Cold War. And if you take, for example, what the developing world, the attitude of the developing world, of the developed world to the developing world, I think you would find that before the end of the Cold War, the richer countries were much more anxious to see that the developing countries were helped in case they fell into the communist hands. And in exactly the same way, the Russians would have done the same. And I think there were advantages in it, and I think we have to realize that we've got to do rather better than we have in the past about the developing world.
Question at the back.
Thank you very much for your very clear reflections upon key events, and I want to find out more from you about Hong Kong. You became Foreign Secretary in 1979. That was the year the Governor of Hong Kong, then later Lord MacLeod, visited Beijing to first floated the problem of the end of the lease in 1997. My question is twofold. First, were there similarities or differences between the British approaches in the negotiations with respect to the Chinese and Argentina? And second, with the benefit of hindsight, looking at what Hong Kong is today and, of course, what China is today, would Britain have taken a different course, or whatever is happening today is the best that can happen? Thank you.
The second one is, in hindsight, do we think it's worked out for the best? Two questions,
I suppose, really, that it worked out for the best. I think it was inevitable what happened. I think there was a great dispute, you remember, in this country about whether Chris Patten was doing the right thing in Hong Kong. And there were two views about it. I think when you look back at it now, I don't think it would have made very much difference whichever view had actually prevailed at that time. I think we were in the impossible position of not being able to call the shots, and we just did our best to negotiate something which we thought was the best for people of Hong Kong. Let's hope it lasts.
The parallelism question, the first one, you were negotiating in a sense with the question of Hong Kong came up, and the question of Argentina came up roughly in parallel with the Falklands.
But my view about a lease of 150 years or so for Britain in the Argentine was based on the presumption that in the year 2000 and something, or 200 and something, the world really would be a quite different place from what it is now.
Of course.
I mean, that was the point. I mean, I don't think that we would have expected the same sort of problem as we had in Hong Kong.
I know there are a large number of people who want to ask questions. Lord Carrington has got to have to go a long way into the country after the lecture, so will you allow me to simply to ask two more questions, and then...
Which I hope I can hear.
Yes, the gentleman there.
My Lord, you mentioned Zimbabwe as one of the continuing problems. Do you think, I mean, there have been charges, both black and white, to Zimbabwe that Britain, you know, has let the country down. Obviously, we've had a very interventionist policy with regards to Yugoslavia and Iraq. Do you think this country could have done more for the people of Zimbabwe in the last kind of 6 or 7 years?
Again, could we have done more about Zimbabwe?
What, after independence, you mean?
Yes.
Could we have done more after
independence? Yes.
I think it would be quite difficult, because I think that almost everything that we did really appeared to those who were supporting President Mugabe to be the sort of old colonial power interfering after independence. And certainly I've always taken the view that the only solution to what is happening in Zimbabwe really lies with the neighbours, in particular with South Africa. I think that our power to do anything is really very limited. I hate it. I mean, I hate to see what's happening. And I think it's shameful and disgraceful. But I think, in a way, it will be difficult to do very much more than we are.
Thank you. Last question.
President Kirchner from Argentina has reactivated his demand for the island sovereignty. I wanted to know, what do you think, if it is possible, Lord Carrington, to negotiate again? And which would be the possibility of negotiation for the island's sovereignty?
Sorry, who has reactivated the...
President Néstor Kirchner. It's an Argentine president. Thank you.
The current Argentine President Kirchner has reopened the question of the future sovereignty of Falkland.
I think it would be a good idea if he shut it.
Now, there the... Mind you all that this is part of a series of lectures with several more to come. On Tuesday, the 21st of October, Lord Howe, who was Foreign Secretary from June 1983 to July 1989, will be talking on problems left over by history. I think you will have gathered from Lord Carrington's lecture tonight that one of the things which any good Foreign Secretary hopes is that problems which are not soluble now can at least be put on ice in the hope that history may indeed solve them, and sometimes history does. But I would like to take this opportunity to thank Lord Carrington very much indeed.